All right. We're ready to begin. If your name is on the list, then circle the number to the left. If it's not, then add it at the bottom and we'll include you in the future. Okay, we're continuing lesson number 3, where we're looking at an overview of the book of Genesis, and our subtitle is A Father's Hurt. We had looked at the beginning chapters. If you think of Genesis in your mind, when you think of Genesis, think chapters 1 to 11. That's the beginning. And then in chapter 12, the story of Abraham begins. And that's the rest of the book of Genesis, the patriarchs. Once we get into Exodus, then we're 400 years later, and the children of Israel number perhaps 1.6 million people from that group of 70 that made the trek from Canaan to Egypt. So, in the first chapters of Genesis, God is attempting to deal with all of mankind. It isn't working. And it fails twice. First, at the time of the flood, there's only Noah and his family left. There's no other believers. Then, after that, the same thing happens. Instead of spreading out through all the world, the people say, well, let's just stay together in the Mesopotamian Valley. We'll make a name for ourselves and everything will be fine. So at the Tower of Babel, one of their ziggurats, as they were called, or worship towers, God confuses their tongues. But there's more to that story than just explaining the origin of language. That story is the preparation for the calling of Abraham. Because in the Mesopotamian Valley, as all of mankind, it's absolutely true still today, people think of time as an ever-turning wheel. And you have a little bit of time on it, but the world keeps on going. It's always been here for billions of years, and it's just going to keep on going. The real existence of the world is in nature itself. And so, in ancient times, people worshipped nature. Main thing in nature was... You're not nature worshipers. What's the main thing without which you're out of luck? The sun, right. And in almost every system of a pantheon of gods in the ancient worlds, the sun god is premier. All right, so you have a world where the wheel just keeps on turning. This keeps on turning. You get on, you're on for a little while, and you die, and that's it. So the purpose of religion, then, is to do the best that you can while you're here. Manipulate nature, crops grow, stuff like that. God calls Abraham, and that's what we're going to look at today, in chapter 12 of Genesis. God calls Abraham, Abram, his name is later changed to Abraham, to come out of the Mesopotamian Valley, come out of civilization. It didn't make any sense. His father Terah left Ur, which is way down where the Tigris and Euphrates rivers come together in what we now call the Persian Gulf. But he followed the Euphrates River way up north. I should go it this way. way up north, and he got to the last city in the Mesopotamian Valley, Haran, and that's where he stayed. Couldn't bring himself to leave the valley. So, God calls Abram out of Haran, out of his father's house, and that brings us to Genesis chapter 12, an important chapter. Okay, so let's take a look at that. Genesis chapter 12. The Lord had said to Abram, leave your country, your people, and your father's household, and go to the land I will show you. So he takes off and he continues on this journey. His father apparently worshiped the Lord, but he also worshiped other gods. Play both ends against the middle and cover all your bases, whatever you want to say. Because when the children of and grandchildren of Abraham go back to Haran looking for a wife, we discover that they have household gods and other things. So, but Abram leaves. And he leaves to a different world. Why would he leave? Why leave his father's house? What in the world would motivate him? Well, Moses tells us right there. Go to the land I will show you. And then he tells him why Abram left. Because God said, I will make you into a great nation. And I will bless you. I will make your name great. And you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse, and all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. What he was doing, what God was doing, was telling Abraham that he should take up the promise that had come from Adam and Eve to Noah down through of this woman's seed who's going to crush Satan's head and reverse the victory. God was going to not let Satan have the victory, and this was going to happen through a child. Woman's seed. A child will be born who is going to change this. So Abram decides, I'm throwing in my lot. He takes lot with him, but I'm throwing in my lot with God. Okay? And instead of this kind of concept of time, there's a different concept. It's like this, like a line. Because God is telling Abram that the future is going to make a difference because of what you do, and that makes a difference. So there's going to be a beginning. There was in Genesis, that story, the story of creation. There's going to be a climax when the woman's seed is born and crushes Satan's head, and it's going to come to an end, this world. Is where Satan is the ruler, is going to come to an end. And Abram decides, that's what I want. And I'm leaving my father's house, and I'm going where God leads me. Where does he lead him? To Canaan. A mountainous stretch there. Nothing to recommend it from an earthly point of view whatsoever. There's the story that the children of Israel wandered for 40 years in the wilderness and settled in the only place that didn't have any oil in the Middle East. But the point is that the land of Canaan didn't have anything. You got Egypt with the Nile, its endless flow of water. You got the Tigris-Euphrates River and civilization. And where does Abram end up? In these mountains. But that's all right, because he believes in God. And it's faith that drives him, because none of the promises that God gave him were fulfilled in his lifetime. And he knew that. How in the world is he going to become a great nation? He's trouble getting one son. But obviously that's not going to happen in his lifetime. And God isn't going to give him this land, the promised land, and the Messiah is somewhere in the future, the woman's seed who's going to be born. All right? But God gives him this promise, and Abram says, I'm out of this endless circle thing. I'm going with God's linear concept of time. So Abram left, verse 4, as the Lord had told him, and Lot went with him. Lot said, I'm going with you. That's his nephew. Abram was 75 years old when he set out from Haran. His wife was 65. He took his wife Sarai, his nephew, her name gets changed to Sarah, that's where Sarai is a little unusual, his nephew Lot, all the possessions they had accumulated and the people they had acquired in Haran, And they set out for the land of Canaan, and they arrived there. So Abraham was, this was quite a deal. He's not a poor, single, lonely guy walking along or something like that. He's got servants and flocks. He's wealthy. Six, Abram traveled through the land as far as the site of the great tree of Moreh at Shechem. Another reason for Abram not to think that this land was, because what the great tree at Moreh, that's a pagan worship site. That's what that is. And Moses tells us at that time the Canaanites were in the land. And of all the pagan people, there were none worse than the Canaanites. They worshipped the ability to reproduce. Sexuality. They, young women became temple prostitutes for a period of time, and they worshiped, and you can imagine how that sucked in the Israelites. Oh, you have this worship? That's interesting. You should come to one of our services. Whoa. And they were often successful as far as that goes. Abram traveled, So the Lord appeared to Abram, verse 7. The Lord appeared to Abram and said, to your offspring I will give this land. So he had told him, I will make of you a great nation. I will bless you. If anybody blesses you, I'll bless them. If they curse you, I'll curse them. And every nation on earth is going to be blessed through you. So your life is going to make a difference. Otherwise, in the ever-turning circle, in the world of evolution in our day, what difference does your life make? See? So all you have to worry about is right now. The life of Abraham is telling us, no. You need to look for the future. Okay? So what happens? So what does Abram do? He built an altar there to the Lord who had appeared to him. He worshipped the Lord in thanksgiving for what had been done. Moses is very spare in his writing. He doesn't tell us very much, and what he tells us is often in pictures. Here's one of them. From there he went on toward the hills east of Bethel and pitched his tent with Bethel on the west and Ai on the east. Now, it's not at all clear that Bethel was there when Abram came. Because later on in the scripture, Jacob calls the place Bethel. Bethel, Beit, in Hebrew, Beit. Beth, where do you see Beth, another geographic name besides Bethel? Bethlehem. Beit Lehem means house of bread, or a place where grain is grown. The house of something is the things that take on the characteristics of that. It's a big term. It's a family. The house of David, you know, or something like that. It's a very large term. And so it may very well be that there wasn't a place called Bethel or Ai when Abram was there, but that's where he camped. And when Moses tells the story, he says where he was. Where was he? Where the children of Israel, remember, Moses is writing this for the children of Israel in Egypt. They're on their way to the promised land. Moses is writing in his day. So they know where Bethel is, and they know where Ai is. The interesting thing, Beth-El, Beit-El, means house of God. And Ai means heap of ruin or destruction. So look at what Abram, or what Moses is telling us. He's traveling through the land. It's filled with the Canaanites and pagans, but God appears to him and he worships the Lord, and he's there between the house of God and ruin or destruction. There he built an altar to the Lord and called on the name of the Lord. Then Abram set out and continued toward the Negev. Negev is the Hebrew word for south. And the Negev is the south. It's the drier part of Israel. So, what does Abram have? He has a tent and an altar. And That's what a man of faith needs. Don't have too tight a grip on the things of this world. You know, you'll have to peel my cold, dead fingers off of them. Otherwise, it's mine. And the life of Abraham is saying, don't get too carried away. It's about the future. It's what's going to happen. That's why each family in the genealogies is named after the father, but it's about the children. It's always forward-looking. It's always looking forward to, for them, the coming of the Messiah in particular, but ultimately the coming of Jesus again at the end of time, which will not most likely be May 21st, if you know what I'm referring to. All right, I'm not going to read the rest of the chapter. Look at the next verse, verse 10. Now there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down to Egypt to live for a while because the famine was so severe. That's not just a little detail. That's a serious problem. Because what did God call Abram to do? To live in the land of Canaan. He didn't say live in the land of Canaan as long as everything is going well. See, and we can miss that. We can just, well, there was a famine. So what did he do? He went to Egypt, because in Egypt, the water in the Nile comes from deep in the heart of Africa, and it wouldn't be affected by a drought there in the Middle East, and he'd have some crops and food for his flocks, and so everything would be all right. And switch that to our life. God calls you to be a child of God. He doesn't call you to abandon that if the going gets tough. You know, he calls you to be a child of God. Well, but bad things are happening to me. My child is sick and may die. My spouse may die. Bad things are happening. So I'm calling into question, you know. Well, remember that we operate by faith. And that's the way it is. And if you don't want to operate by faith, then just assume that the world just goes on, and you're on the world for a little while, and you're going to fall off, and that's the end of you. But otherwise, you're going to have to live by faith, and that's hard when disappointment comes. So, all right, let's look at our sheet. Genesis 12 marks a momentous change in Genesis. It sets the pattern for God's dealing with the human race from that point on until the coming of the Messiah and the day of Pentecost. Day of Pentecost was kind of a reversal of the Tower of Babel, wasn't it? On that day, the disciples spoke in tongues. Because God was going to reach out into all the world. So what happened is God was sharing the gospel with all of mankind, but it failed. They didn't follow. And so in the flood, God saved Noah and his family, because ultimately, humanly speaking at least, there wouldn't have been anyone left who was a believer. And then in the Tower of Babel, he forced human beings to separate and go out into all the world. But now God narrows his focus. He calls one man, doesn't call him when he's 21 or 25 or 30, calls him when he's 75, and his wife is 65, and he says to them, I'm going to make of you a great people. Though he got some disappointment, in fact, 25 years of it set up. So the Lord decides he will no longer deal with the whole of humanity. He will create his own people from the ground up. So he calls one man and his wife, Abraham and Sarah. So don't get confused when you see in the beginning of the story, Abram and Sarai. There, Abram is a great father, and Abraham means father of many nations. And Sarah and Sarai are not so clear. Both have to do with princess. The story is told in the remainder of Genesis. We'll overview the stories of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, in order to gain some insight into how God works in our time. because that's what we're looking at. We're going to see the history of God dealing with the children of Israel, but our subject is disappointment with God. How does God deal with his people? Paul said that the stories of the Old Testament believers were written for our learning. Let's see what we can learn. Abram emerges from the pages of the Bible as the first person whose struggles with faith we come to understand. What do you know of Adam and Eve? You know what happened, but we don't meet them as people. A little bit of Noah. He certainly was steadfast, wasn't he? 120 years he's building this ark. But still, we don't see him struggling with disappointments and so forth. But we do with Abram. So for the first time, we see someone who gets disappointed with God. He's an example of a man severely disappointed in God. God spoke a promise to him that was wonderful, direct, and clear. I should have read this first and then, but we just read Genesis 12. So after the promise, I'll make of you a great nation. I'll bless the whole world through you. I'll give this land to you. A blaze of revelation. What comes? Disappointment. Go claim the land I have given to you, God says. But as the years go by, Abram finds that Canaan is dry as a bone. There is a severe famine in the land, and trusting in God doesn't make rain fall or wells fill up. Faith proves too difficult, and Abram is called to be in Canaan, but flees to Egypt. So that's where we are. But God tells him, you'll have descendants as countless as the stars in the sky and the grains of sand on the seashore. No promise could have made Abraham and Sarah happier. At 75 and 65, they were delighted that they could look forward to the sound of children's laughter in their tent. But Sarah stayed as slim as she had ever been, and at 65 and 75, you don't have much time. Faith is very difficult. In his late 70s or early 80s, Abraham concludes that the Lord isn't coming through for him, or at the very least, the Lord needs some help. So Abram decides to do what people did in his day if they didn't have any children. They adopted a servant in their household. You can read clay tablets that have been dug up in Mesopotamia that are contracts where somebody says, this servant, names the servant, in my household will be my heir, and he treats him as a son. So God's not coming through, so Abram figures, well, I'll help him along here. I'll adopt this Eliezer of Damascus as his son. Then the Lord appears to him and tells him that this servant will not be his heir. Okay. But then more years go by, and no heir. Sarah's periods are regular as clockwork. The promised son, God said, will come from Abram's own body. A decade or so goes by. It's hard to gauge exactly the time when you're reading Genesis, but some considerable time. And Abraham isn't getting any younger, and neither is Sarah. So at 85, he and Sarah work out a smarmy backup plan involving an Egyptian maidservant. Well, if the woman's seed is going to come from my body, then I can have this affair with her maidservant. Now, you can read the story in different ways. Did Abram force this on Sarah? I rather believe that they came up with it together. I don't know. It's hard to say. But Abram has an affair with this Hagar, an Egyptian maidservant, and he has a child. this Lord, he never gives up. He never lets up, rather. And he tells him that Ishmael will not be the heir, and finally tells him to drive his mother and his son away. Because this is that you did this, but this is not the right thing. So, by the time he was 99, this whole plan of the Lord, that he's going to make him a great nation, and he's going to, his people, his descendants will inherit the land, and this woman's seed is going to be born from Abraham. He's 99. His wife is 89. It just seemed ludicrous. And when God showed up to confirm the plan, they laughed in his face. Now, that's an interpretation. You can take that to when Sarah learns that she's going to have a child, she laughs. Does she laugh because she's delighted that she's going to have a child? Well, certainly in retrospect, that was true. But maybe she thought, well, this is ridiculous. This is not going to happen. I don't know. We don't have to decide. What kind of game was God playing? He dangled a bright dream of fertility and a child before a barren couple, a child that would give their whole, that should be their whole life meaning, and was the reason for leaving the Mesopotamian valley and civilization. It was the whole thing that you would have this child. And then what does God do? He sits on his hands and watched as they advanced toward tottery old age. What did God want from them? Well, they get a son. And they name him Laughter. Yitzchak, Isaac. And you think, okay, everything is wonderful. God comes through. My goodness, they have a child. You can imagine, I suppose he was spoiled as could be. I don't know. You know. But he grows up into a young man. And they just couldn't be happier. Everything is just going wonderfully. Oops. Out of the clear blue, one day, God appears to Abraham and tells him, I want you to go to this place, Moriah, in the land of Moriah, almost certainly where Jerusalem would later be, and almost certainly as well where the Temple of Solomon would be built, where sacrifices would take place. And he tells him, I want you to sacrifice your son as a burnt offering to me. There's nothing in the text, nothing that Moses tells us that says that Sarah had anything to do with this. I don't know if she would have gone along. I don't know. But it's amazing. The Danish philosopher, Lutheran philosopher, Kierkegaard, you might remember that name from high school or college, Kierkegaard, wrote a book about this incident of God asking Abraham to sacrifice his son, and he called it Fear and Trembling. And it's a study of what it means to trust in God. When he's just about reached adulthood, God comes with this. So let's look at Genesis 22. Now remember, as we read this story, that Moses is telling this story from a distance. And how it turns out is known by all of his readers. I mean, they know this story. You have to look at this from two points of view. One is from Moses' point of view as he tells the story, but also from Abraham's point of view, who doesn't know how this is going to turn out. All right, so chapter 22. Some time later, Moses' way of not telling us exactly when this took place, God tested Abraham. We know that but Abraham doesn't. It's like what other book in the Bible? A tough question.
What's the question?
Yeah, this story is like another book in the Bible. Job. In the story of Job, the first chapters are between God and Satan. And Satan is saying, well, sure, you take care of Job, and yeah, he's a wonderful believer, but he's got no problems. So God says, okay, go ahead. See what you can do. And we're pretty uncomfortable. We'd like to jump into the latter part of the book where Job is complaining about all the things that happened. We can connect with that. We're not so comfortable with the idea that the Lord is allowing this to happen. That's a little difficult. All right, so we know from Moses that God tested Abraham. Abraham didn't. So he said to him, Abraham, here I am, Lord. Things are going just wonderfully. Sarah and I are so grateful for this child, and the future looks bright, and trusting in you was difficult for us. We're sorry for the ways that we failed to trust in you, but everything is wonderful. Then God said, take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the region of Moriah. Sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains I will tell you about. It's like God is making sure that there's no mistaking what he's saying. Take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love. I know how you feel. But this is what I want you to do. Early the next morning, Abraham got up and saddled his donkey. You know this story is going to turn out well. In the whole of the Old Testament, if God says something to someone and they do it, it's going to turn out well. If God says something to some individual or to the children of Israel and they don't do it, duck. It is not going to be pretty. But Abraham gets up early in the morning and saddles his donkey. He took with him two of his servants and his son Isaac. When he had cut enough wood for the burnt offering, he set out for the place God had told him about. On the third day, God is tough. Takes him 3 days, probably two nights. He leaves early in the morning. Takes him 3 days to get there. Two nights. Two nights with wonderful childlike sleep, huh? So by the time that Abram gets to the place where God wants him to be, he is not doing well. So he looked up and he saw the place in the distance. He said to the servants, stay here with the donkey while I and the boy go over there, points to the mountain. We will worship and then we will come back to you. How to interpret that? Is this an expression, very possibly, an expression of the faith of Abraham that he says, I don't know how this is going to work out, but everything is tied up in this child, and if God wants me to sacrifice him, that's what I'm going to do, but God is going to figure this out. Or maybe he's just telling them something because he isn't going to share with them what God has commanded him to do. In any case, Abraham took the wood for the burnt offering and placed it on his son Isaac. And he himself carried the fire and the knife. The fire is a word that means the little kit that they carried that had flint and little thin shavings of wood and that they could make a fire with, you know, rather than he's carrying some coals, burning coals in something. And the knife, that's all he needs for an offering. As the two of them went on together, Isaac spoke up, Moses writes. What he did was stabbed his father in the heart. Isaac spoke up and said to his father Abraham, Father, yes, my son, Abraham replied. The fire and the wood are here, Isaac said, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering? Abraham answered, God himself will provide the lamb for the burnt offering. my son. And the two of them went on together. And I personally think that when he said that he would come back, he believed that. My whole life has been spent depending on the Lord. I'm not going back now. So God is going to provide. When they reached the place God had told him about, and ancient, very ancient tradition has that as the site of Solomon's temple. And today the Islamic Dome of the Rock is built over that spot. Now, if that's not the exact spot, that doesn't make any difference. But that's very ancient tradition. That's not something from 500 years ago. That's something from 3,000 years ago. So he gets there. Abraham built an altar there and arranged the wood on it. How many times did he arrange that wood? He bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Then he reached out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called out to him from heaven, "Abraham, Abraham." That's the first time that term, the angel of the Lord. When we hear that word angel, we immediately think of a creature that is a messenger of God, you know, doesn't have a body. But angel means messenger. And it almost seems as it did when the Lord appeared to Moses in the burning bush, that the angel of the Lord is the Lord. And therefore Christians have said, well, who would be the messenger of the Lord and be the Lord? And the answer is Jesus, right. Now, we don't absolutely know that, but that makes sense. So the angel of the Lord called out to him from heaven, "Abraham, Abraham." "Here I am," he replied. "Do not lay a hand on the boy," he said. "Do not do anything to him. Now I know that you fear God, because you have not withheld from me your son, your only son." Who really knew that he feared God? Who?
Just God.
Yeah, but God knew that all along, didn't he?
Isaac.
Oh, Isaac. And of all the patriarchs, Isaac is the one who did the best. That's interesting. But Abram learns. All right? Abram looked up, and there in the thicket he saw a ram caught by its horns. I thought they were looking for a lamb. See that word lamb? We always think of the cuddly little thing that you make an animal out of, you know, a stuffed animal, a lamb. The lamb that you sacrificed was a year old, and if it was a male, it's a ram. It's virtually a full-grown sheep. Yes?
I was kind of interesting that Isaac, you know, doesn't try to get away.
Well, how do you know that? You don't know that.
No, that's true.
Yeah.
But my point is sort of like
Christ's life. Well, I'm only making the point that Moses tells us only what he absolutely has to tell us. You can speculate about what might have happened, and there's nothing wrong with that as long as you don't change the story. It's interesting, though, nowhere else in the Bible does any of the writers ever pick this up. That doesn't make it any less foreshadowing of Jesus Christ, but it doesn't get picked up. That's interesting. Yes, Alex?
Well, in verse 12, this little word that takes away the speculation on who the angel of the Lord was.
Now I know.
From me.
Yeah. Right.
So he's saying he didn't withhold him from God. So me being God, the angel of the Lord, had to be Jesus.
Well, yes, except that somebody could say that the messenger of the Lord speaks for the Lord. He brings the Lord's message, not the angel's message.
Well,
but I agree with you. I'm not disagreeing with you. And especially, it just comes even more powerfully in the appearance of God in the burning bush. It just, I mean, it just makes sense, you know. So, yes, God is speaking. He wants this. So there's this ram caught by its horns in the thicket. He went over and took the ram and sacrificed as a burnt offering instead of his son. Oh, my goodness. Jesus is sacrificed instead of us. It's a beautiful picture. So Abraham called that place, "The Lord will provide." That was the faith with which he went forward. God is going to provide this. I don't know how, but he's going to provide it. On the mountain of the Lord, it will be provided. Interesting that he calls it the mountain of the Lord, and then later on, very ancient tradition tells us that this is the site of the temple in Jerusalem. Yes?
Well, I was thinking, we were talking earlier about Abraham and how he was bringing Isaac up to the mountain. And for me, I always thought that Abraham was just showing his faith after he and Sarah had waited so long for the baby, the miracle of Isaac, to be proved that, you know, that God does do his promises. So when I visualize Abraham and Isaac, I kind of see how God knew that when Jesus would be crucified, that he would be resurrected from the dead, you know, and that, and so I look at Abraham.
That is a reasonable way to look at it, and that is the way the writer of Hebrews looks at it, okay? Now remember, though, we have a particular goal in reading this story. We certainly want to see that God is going to redeem the world and see that here, but we're talking about disappointment with God. And the point here is that Abraham goes forward in faith. And then God repeats it. The angel of the Lord called to Abraham from heaven a second time and said, "I swear by myself." Yeah, I can swear by God. I swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God. Who is God going to swear by? He makes an oath, though, and he swears, of course, by himself. "I swear by myself, declares the Lord, that because you have done this and have not withheld your son, your only son, I will surely bless you and make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as the sand on the seashore." Now, when we hear this story and we apply it to ourselves, you can immediately jump to the angel of the Lord appearing and the ram being caught in the thicket. But the point of the story for us is Abraham journeying in fear and trembling for 3 days, trusting in the Lord, not seeing, simply trusting. "But I will make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and as the sand on the seashore. Your descendants will take possession of the cities of their enemies, and through your offspring all nations on earth will be blessed because you have obeyed me." And remember that obey in Old Testament terms, obey means trust, believe. You obeyed me. I told you what to do, and you trusted in me. Your descendants will take possession of the cities of their enemies, and through your offspring all nations on earth will be blessed. That's the promised Messiah. Then Abraham returned to his servants, and they set off together for Beersheba, and Abraham stayed in Beersheba on the south side of Israel. Abraham never saw the land. I'm back in the guide. Abraham never saw the land become his descendants' land. He never saw the woman's seed who would crush Satan's head and be a blessing to all nations. He saw only a down payment on the promises in the birth of a son. It was enough. And is Christ's promise to return enough for us to continue on this linear idea instead of seeing ourselves on this ever-turning wheel that the world around us suggests is reality? So Abraham never saw that. He never saw the woman's seed who would crush Satan's head and be a blessing to all nations. He only saw a down payment on the promises in the birth of a son, but it was enough because Abraham had the one thing that God wanted. See, what does God... Does God want people who will do what they're supposed to do? What's the answer to that question? Yes or no?
Yes.
No.
It's no. God does not simply want people who will... Otherwise, he could have created a bunch of people who would always do right things. Wouldn't he? I mean, so we just make people who never sin. But God doesn't want people who will always do the right thing. He wants people who want to do the right thing. Yes?
David. So, I'm still stuck on this thing about God failing. You know, but like you said, he doesn't want people to do, you know, to be robots-like. Mm-hmm. So, it still seems like this isn't a failure plan. It's possibly how...
Well, I think the word is just tough, because we don't really disagree, David. The word, fail. God, fail, that's not possible. But, look, you don't get to view things from God's point of view. From God's point of view, does he fail? No. He sometimes shares his point of view, but he shares other points of view, too. And if everybody in the world, except Noah, is a believer, and it looks like that's all going to go to hell in a handbasket too, that's a failure. It didn't work. Okay? But I'm not talking, I mean, you know, we can argue and say, well, God always knew what was going to happen. You get all of these things that become impossible for us to deal with. It didn't work the way God wanted it to work. Okay? I only call it a failure because that word grabs us. Okay, that's what I'm doing. And Noah surely must have felt that way. There's nobody who cares. I'm building this ark. The world's going to come to an end as we know it. I mean, you know, everybody is going to die. Do they care? No, they keep on giving in marriage and doing everything. And it looked like it was all going to come crashing down around his head. But it didn't. Of course. So from God's point of view, it wasn't a failure. That's how I'm using the word failure.
In a way, yeah. I think of it, yeah, Adam and Eve sinned, they blew it, but this is sort of a plan where he could show his goodness and mercy to many people.
Yeah, but see, you're putting yourself in God's place.
Yeah.
And you're saying
that
when Adam and Eve, well, we all do, that when Adam and Eve fell into sin, that was all a part of God's plan, see? You don't get to look at it from that point of view. Yes, it's true. My human reason will tell me that if God chose me from before the world was created to be his child, and I'm born in sin, he must have known all this. But whenever you use phrases like, he must have known, or you can only conclude, or something like that, then you're not taking God's word. So let's, you know, I understand what you're feeling. I feel the same thing. But how can I deal with God? If God knew what was going to happen in the Garden of Eden, then in my mind it's his fault.
Yeah, I'm not necessarily saying he knew, but since they blew it, I mean, he knew that possibility existed. So
sure. But see, the whole speculation does not lead you anywhere. It doesn't help you understand what God is doing. God does, as far as the idea that God is going to reach out with his love. The angels are amazed, you know, in Jesus' parable. The angels are amazed about God's love for people who don't seem to care about him. That's amazing to them. And they're happy about it.
Sure.
So just, you know, everything you're saying is correct. I mean, correct in the sense that we all feel that way. But always think to yourself, if I'm trying to make this make sense, am I getting on the other side and looking at things from God's point of view and then figuring out, gee, Lord, why did, you know, I'm having all this trouble. Why don't you just figure it out, you know? Well, your job, my job, is to believe that he will, even though I don't see it. And faith is not the substance of things seen. That's what the script, faith is the substance of things not seen, the evidence of things hoped for. So that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to realize that we can be in the same position as these people were, whether it's Abraham, later we're going to look at Job, you know, and see what God is telling us so that this faith thing makes sense. But how do I know that it's all right? You know what? Maybe this is all the invention of those Jews back there, those Israelites. You know, they just created a God. They're no different than anybody else. And this whole Messiah thing, you know, there are people who they're not about to hitch their boat to something that they don't know. Like you can hitch your boat to something you know? I mean, we're talking to a whole bunch of people who are dying. They're dying. They don't have a single thing that they can hang on to. So here comes God, who reveals himself to these people and tells us he wants us to want to do what's right, to love him and do the right thing because they want to. That's what this is about. So it's hard. It's not easy. All right? Let's see. So it was enough because Abraham had the one thing that God truly wanted. Hebrews 11 explains what that was. Let's look at Hebrews 11, almost to Revelation. Hebrews chapter 11. This is the chapter about faith. We're not going to read the whole chapter, but we're going to look at the parts that had to do with Abraham, which is the largest part of that chapter.
Chapter 11.
Chapter 11 of Hebrews. Bring your Bible in the future or grab one. They're up there. All right. So faith, there it is. Beginning of chapter 11. Now, faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. Certain and sure? We see our old Adam says, our sinful self says, I don't want faith. Forget this faith stuff. I want to know. Well, you know what? When it comes to relationships, there is no knowing. I can give you an example of this. A wife says, I know that my husband is faithful to me because in the 26 years that we have been married, he has never been out of my sight. Wonderful relationship, huh? What is knowing? Knowing does not have meaning in the way that we use it. When Job says, I know that my Redeemer lives and that I will see him at the last day, that's faith. But in relationships, what makes a relationship? It's trust. And so we go, well, I can't, you know, how do you know all that stuff that the Bible says? You know, people will put, I've been on planes, you know, and people say, well, you know, the Bible, how do you know if any of that stuff is true? They don't know anything about the Bible, you know. But when it comes to religion, everybody is an expert. If you use this example, you may have heard it, me use it before. If you sat down in an airplane next to a guy who designed bridges, you wouldn't be likely to tell him what your theory about building bridges was. Because you don't know a thing about building bridges. But people will, they think that they know what religion is about. You know, knowing nothing. You might know what religion is about. If you're listening to the scriptures, you may know that. But people will say things about the Bible and three questions and you know they never read anything in the Bible. At all, period. Nothing. Not one thing. But they have an opinion about the Bible. It's somebody else gave them. Part of that ever-turning wheel, that philosophy that sees life that way. That's not interested in the scripture because the scripture is linear. Beginning, climax, end. All right, so let's jump to Abraham to verse 8. By faith, Abraham, when called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, and he didn't receive it, obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. By faith, he made his home in the promised land, like a stranger in a foreign land. So it's the land that he's going to receive in his children, but he's a wanderer, a Bedouin. A wandering Aramean is the way the Bible puts it. Like a stranger in a foreign country, he lived in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city with foundations, whose architect and builder is God. And that, of course, is the new heaven and the new earth. By faith, Abraham, even though he was past age, and Sarah herself was barren, was enabled to become a father because he considered him faithful who had made the promise. You trust in God, and what seems impossible becomes possible. But my old Adam says, I can't see it. And if I can't see it, I can't believe in it. And so from this one man, and he is good as dead, came descendants as numerous as the stars of the sky and as countless as the sand on the seashore. Are you one of the descendants of Abraham? Yeah? All of you are. Who are the descendants of Abraham, the children of Abraham? Those who share the faith of Abraham. Blood lineage was important in the Old Covenant. It's not in the New. So, verse 13, all these people were still living by faith when they died. They did not receive the things promised. They only saw them and welcomed them from a distance. In a view of life that where time is an ever-turning circle, that's absolutely meaningless. Because just read the first chapters of Ecclesiastes. There's nothing new under the sun. What has been is what will be. And so Solomon is saying, that's the view of the world. It's an ever-turning wheel. They admitted that they were aliens and strangers on earth, so the earth is not their be-all. Think of the ways in which the world around us becomes the be-all of everything. When you're growing up, you know, peer pressure. It becomes everything, and it takes people different decades in their life to get over that and start doing what they think is the right thing to do and not worry about what other people think. But, you know, the world is a powerful thing, and it becomes the be-all and the end-all. People who do such things, who admit that they are aliens and strangers on earth, people who say such things show that they are looking for a country of their own. If they had been thinking of the country they had left, they would have had opportunity to return. So, it's not working out. Let's go back to Haran. It's better than these hills up here, and there's no rain, and it's really a problem. Instead, they were longing for a better country, a heavenly one. They had a linear idea of what was going to happen. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. By faith, Abraham, when God tested him, offered Isaac as a sacrifice. He who had received the promise was about to sacrifice his one and only son, even though God had said to him, "It is through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned." That's what Abraham clung to. God told him, "Your offspring will be counted through Isaac." Abraham reasoned that God could raise the dead, and figuratively speaking, he did receive Isaac back from death. Because in the Hebrew way of thinking, once he made up his mind that he was going to do that, that's what mattered, not that God stopped him. By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau in regard to the future. That looks further ahead where we are. All right? And the pattern continued. Isaac's wife Rebekah was barren, and so was Jacob's wife Rachel. It's all going to be through children being born, and we just have this plague of infertility. Sarah, Rebecca, and Rachel all spent their best childbearing years slender and in despair. After the bright blaze of revelation from God came dark and lonely times of disappointment and waiting that only faith could fill. Well, this is our, we'll finish that up. There's only a little bit left as we look at the rest of Genesis. And then we're going to look at a larger period from Exodus to the days of Solomon, King Solomon. And after that, the time of the prophets, Elijah and Elisha. What do they have to tell us about disappointment with God? So next time, you might want to bring that last page. We'll have a new guide, but we'll finish up this one. Have a blessed week.